Tonight I'm interviewing Pamela Ditchoff, author of The Mirror of Monsters and Prodigies, which was published by Coffee House Press. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
I wanted to talk first about your book, The Mirror of Monsters and Prodigies. So why don't you tell me what it's all about?
It's a fictionalized oral history of human oddities. It begins in ancient kingdom, Egypt, and goes up to the 1970s. And there are dwarves, giants, conjoined twins, bearded women, some famous people like Tom Thumb, Jojo the Dog-Faced Boy is another one that was quite well known. The people in the book are taken from history. None of the characters are fictionalized. The events, the history surrounding each character in each period is authentic. Only the voices are fictionalized. I tried to get into the heads of the people and the time period and speak from where they were and what they were feeling.
Okay, so how did you get interested in this admittedly unusual topic?
Well, it started with a short story about 1991, I think, that was on the demise of the modern sideshow and carnival. And after I wrote that story, I started researching and found so many characters. And I thought they were fascinating. I wanted to research more. And of course, the library here at Michigan State is fabulous for that, because the special collections has some items that are very hard to find. And I live close by, living in East Lansing. We're very fortunate to have this wonderful library here. Another reason, I guess my fascination, when I was very young, there were still sideshows at the county fairs, at the Ingham County Fair, mm-hmm. I remember precisely. My parents took my brother and my sister and I, and my brother and sister went off with my dad to go on the rides, and I would always get sick on rides, so I didn't go. And my mom and I stood at the front of the midway, and there was a bally there, a stage where performers will do a bit of an act or show a few characters so you can get an idea of what it's like. And this was a sideshow, and on the stage there was a fat lady, a tattooed man, a alligator woman, and a man that was thin and drove spikes up his nose. And I was very young, probably four, and I had a very large birthmark on my face. I went up close to the stage, and the tattooed man lifted me up on the stage. And the alligator woman asked me if I wanted to touch her skin, that it was really very soft. And she held her arm out, and I did touch her skin, and it was very silky. I don't think that it was because of my birthmark that they lifted me up on the stage. I just think that they were very kind people, and that children are not affected the same way mm-hmm. as adults are. Children have a natural curiosity for things that are different. And until they're told, don't stare, don't look at that poor, unfortunate person, then they don't experience that. They don't know that that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So that's a long answer to your question.
That's a fascinating story, though. Thanks. In the novel, you write in a variety of different narrative voices. How difficult was that for you?
It wasn't difficult once I researched the period, because when you know what's going on, say in the court of Peter the Great, who was a lunatic, an absolute maniac lunatic, and kept dwarves at court. when you study about the time period, the politics that are going on, the wars, the social customs, it was very easy for me to get into those characters. And I have to say that these people were not the people that were locked away in attics or whatever, or hid themselves. Mm-hmm. These are people that distinguished themselves enough to be remembered in history. So they were really remarkable people. Or someone, promoter, found them that could make them remarkable, as P.T. Barnum did with so many people. But still, for example, the very first character is a dwarf who was keeper of the royal wardrobe to Pharaoh Pepi II. And the pharaoh was so fond of this man that when the dwarf died, there is a tomb that the pharaoh built especially for him that has his name on the tomb, and that tomb was featured in National Geographic about 4 or 5 years ago. So it's not difficult to get into the characters and into the time period. In fact, they talk to me in my dreams, in my sleep. This was a story that wanted to be told.
It sounds like it. And so you say you researched your topic primarily here, or are there any books that influenced you, primary texts that influenced you, or did you have to look basically through newspapers, magazines?
Mm-hmm. There were some texts. Frederick Drimmer wrote a book titled Very Special People, and Leslie Fielder, Freaks... The Freak Among Us, or
I've actually read that book.
And then with other things, I had to look. I had to research and dig through things to find and to verify. And sometimes there were newspaper articles, reviews of films like Freaks, Irving Thalberg's Freaks in 32. I was able to find 3 or 4 movie reviews of that. So after reading the reviews and the public reaction, then I could write a post-screening party of the cast and how they would react to the reviews.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. This is just for the writers who are listening. Can you describe what your daily writing routine is like, or your ritual when you are writing a book?
I spend probably, I start about 10 o'clock and go until 5 with lunch and lunch break.
Pretty serious writing, straight through.
Yeah, well, sometimes, of course, if it's, there'll be some research too, gathering it, reading through it. So it's not necessarily straight writing unless it's at a stage where it's complete and I'm editing, as you know, then you're frantically frantically going through and getting it right and spending lots and lots of hours. So that's my routine.
Well, you're reading tonight for the Michigan Writers Series at the library a portion of your second novel, which is Mrs. Beast. And I'm going to ask you the question I asked you about your first novel. What is Mrs. Beast about?
Mrs. Beast takes up where the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast left off. Well, about 3 months later. Beauty is married to the prince, and she discovers that she preferred him as the Beast. He's his same old vain, arrogant, horrid self, and she misses the Beast. And essentially, she decides to go on a quest to find the enchantress that changed him to a beast in the first place and ask her to change him back. In order to do that, she has to go through Grimland. Now, Beauty and the Beast is a French fairy tale. Well, who knows originally, but the French are given credit. And I like Beauty because she was the only fairy tale beauty that went after the beast or her prince. She did not sit around and wait for someone to rescue her or come to her. So when she embarks on the quest, she goes through Grimland, and along the way she meets Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Rapunzel, and Cinderella, and finds out what happened to them after Happily Ever After. Mm-hmm. And it's not pretty, as we can expect.
So this is a funny novel, too.
Yes,
a very
this
funny
is very,
novel.
Well, I think it's quite funny, mm-hmm. yes. Witty is used a lot, and sharp-edged.
Okay, great. So how did you rewrite some of the traditional fairy tales where the females are almost always depicted as passive and dependent? Can you give me the example of what might have happened, or a specific example from the book?
Well, the problem with passive dependent, and I don't know that they're always passive, they're certainly dependent, but the problem is that in fairy tales, the beauties are chosen only for their looks. For example, Sleeping Beauty. The prince finds her and kisses her awake and marries her. Well, she's been asleep for 100 years. And it doesn't take long for him to become very bored with her and think she's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
She tries to study and learn, but of course the marriage doesn't work. Because it was based on her looks only.
Mm-hmm.
She in the book she returns to her home, which is the Kingdom of Dreams in my book, and of course all of her family are dead. Everyone she cared about is dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's been 100 years. And she cultivates opium at the Kingdom of Dreams, and she's an opium addict. All she wants to do is go back to sleep.
Well, that certainly is a twist on the traditional.
That's an example. I mean, if you stop and think about the possibility of these women being happy under the circumstances, it's insane.
Mm-hmm.
How
mm-hmm.
can... But, you know, they're fairy tales. But the reason that I wrote it is it's a real issue with me. I don't like young girls being influenced by the belief that if you're only pretty enough, you're going to get it all. You're going to get the prince, you're going to get the castle, you're going to be the princess. If only you're pretty enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And instead we should be saying, no, be beautiful inside, develop your mind, develop your body, develop your talents, and you'll love yourself. And then you can love somebody else. But if you're holding up some impossible image that continues and continues on billboards and fashion magazines, in films, it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad thing for girls.
I agree.
I want girls to be strong.
I want to end this interview. I hear you're working on another unusual project or an interesting project. You just want to give a few words to that. You started some research on your nonfiction project.
Oh, the nonfiction project. Yes, that's a biography on the Hilton twins, who were conjoined twins. They do appear in my first book. But they were probably, besides Chang and Eng, who were the first Siamese mm-hmm. twins, they were really the most famous. They performed in vaudeville. They were paid $5,000 a week and up during their prime, and their life was really very interesting. And so I would like to do a biography, a creative biography, on the lives of Violet and Daisy, two remarkable women.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. I want to thank you, Pamela, for coming here tonight, and I look forward to your reading.
It's my pleasure, Maria.
Okay,
thank you.
You.